Monster Professor.
Welcome to The Monster Professor, a show in which we discuss and explore monsters in literature, myth, film, games, folklore, culture, and beyond. I'm your host, Josh Woods, author, editor, professor, and monster expert. And this is an odd podcast episode, one unlike any I've ever done before, in that if you're hearing the pure audio, I'm going to have a lot of describing to do for you. If you're watching this, if you're watching this on YouTube, it's almost making sense maybe for you. So what I have going on are three guests, and I'm really happy to have them. I'm going to introduce them here in a minute. And we're recording this via Zoom. And so you've got the pure audio if you're just listening, but if you're watching this on YouTube, you see us Brady Bunch gallery style right now, in which we're not only on Zoom, but we're playing with other programs to make fake masks, or not fake masks, they're masks really, but we have virtually enhanced faces of different kinds, and virtual backgrounds, or playing with those a little bit in one way or another. And so I'll do my best to describe what's going on as it goes on. And I don't really know how to host a show with four people total. I guess I'm just going to figure that out as we go along. So how about I get into some introductions now? Oh, by the way, just to clarify, what kind of masks are, what do you have going on? I have right now kind of a classic Wolfman look, and I'm extending my bottom teeth to enhance the Wolfman look.
The glasses really make it though. It's a very very erudite werewolf.
Yeah,
it gentles the look somehow.
The werewolf doesn't have to be dumb, does he? Can he be bestial and
no, I'm
nerdy?
I'm not objecting. I think it's charming. Really complete. They complete the whole thing. Plus the eyebrows kind of, you know, like cascade over the upper rims of the glasses.
Oh so yeah,
it's a really bushy eyebrows.
and I guess my background is, I like to think of it as the House of Usher. That's one of my favorite places to revisit about every year is to I'll return.
Buy it as House of Usher.
it's somebody else. Yeah, I think it's rain or snow. I got a fire kind of crackling in the background. I took somebody else's a gothic room YouTube video, by the way, and didn't ask permission. So if I get attacked on YouTube, it's probably valid. And Pinkney, who was just speaking, well, why don't you let me you describe what your face is and what your background is.
Well, I mean, that's a really, the face is a Snapchat filter, which if folks don't know, just get the Snapcam app for your desktop PC, and it gives you access to all the Snapchat filters, which are intoxicating. And the one I'm wearing right now is Robot Queen, it is called.
She's gorgeous.
You know, yeah, so it's a kind of mechanical, it's you know, biomechanical. There seems to be sort of a third eye up above my regular eyes, and it's you know, half metal and half kind of dramatic makeup. And behind me, depending on how you want to think about it, are at the moment either carnival lights or disco lights, in keeping with my biomechanical appearance at the moment.
You look a little kabuki as well.
No, there is that, right? The, you know, that it's it's kind of a you know, emotionless in a way, I guess. What I'm finding out is that I love masks. Like, what a great thing. Why don't we wear them all the time? I'm realizing I have to get one of those N95 masks, but I need it to be one of those things that makes the lower half of your face like a grinning skull.
Yeah.
that, you know, that I think all of this can be turned to the advantage of people who love monsters.
Yeah. Yeah. Very cool. And Sarah, you've got a bunch of eyes. Describe that for us.
I do. I have several eyes that I can wink.
Like the whole side of your face winks. I mean, that's just,
yeah, your entire creepy. Face is studded with eyes that are alive.
Yeah. It's a little frightening. And I'm in the bedroom of the twin girls from The Shining, basically. I've gathered up all of the fake plants in this apartment, and I have positioned them around me as if it were a very low budget funeral. Yep. And that's where my life is at right now.
And being broadcast, no less. And Mandy, you've got some real, either you have really good virtual masks going on, or you've got some real world costuming going on. So what do you have going on, Mandy?
This is my Queen Amidala look that I put together for TikTok as well as Zoom. And it's definitely makeup, but that's why I can't have a virtual background, because it apparently thinks I'm part of the green screen.
That's funny. Yeah, so we've got some sci-fi themed and horror themed coming in here, and I think monsters have worked well in both genres, if we're going to separate them as genres, which is kind of false to do. So let me run through, I'll try to be brief with official introductions of my guests here. They both have such long lists of credentials and accomplishments that it's tough to be brief. I'm going to try to go fast here. We've got Mandy Jordan. She graduated summa cum laude from SIUC, and with a BA in creative writing and a minor in classics. As undergrad, she was Chancellor Scholar, received honors diploma for her thesis, William Shakespeare's Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, which is a great title, by the way. Author of the novels Lacrimosa, Veritas, and The Silence. Short story collections, Shadows of the Mind and Immortal Descent. Stories have appeared all over the place. Missouri Review, Switchblade, Technoir, Factor 4 Magazine, Mad Scientist Journal, Colored Lens, tons of others. Over 100 publications, which is insane. Founder and co-editor of, how do you pronounce it, by the way? Because I'm just going to screw it up.
Al-Sayani.
All right. Well, thank you. And that's for speculative fiction and poetry. Grad student, she adapted and directed her novel Lacrimosa for the stage. She won the Missouri Review's Miller Audio Prize for prose in 2019, short fiction piece Inheritance and Shadows of the Mind podcast based on her novel series. They're available on all major listening platforms. Currently a master's fellow at SIUC and is going to graduate, or just has, with her MFA in fiction. Are you in process? Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. Congratulations on that. Sarah Gielick, we've got her here with us as well. She was born and raised in DeKalb, Illinois. She earned a BA in creative writing with an MFA in fiction from SIUC. Her work has appeared or is forthcoming all over the place, Illinois Emerging Writers, Bronzeville, Prime Number Magazine. I don't know if you can catch some background noise, but I have cats going crazy and ravens screaming outside right now. And that seems to fit. So yeah. I'm just going to let it be. Let's see, all-female issue of Switchblade, and that got nominated for Best American Mystery Stories 2019. The publication Tough, where she was nominated for a Derringer Award, one of the cooler sounding awards to have in your in your sock. She has done voice acting and sound editing for podcast Locker 13, Dear Murder Street, Knight of Another Sort, Saints and Witches as well. Her novel Saint Catastrophe is forthcoming from SFK Press, which is an awesome press, by the way, in August 2020. And I have Monster Professor Podcast VIP Pinkney Benedict, our most frequent guest and far and away my favorite, and a mentor of mine and a teacher and mentor to my other guests, Mandy and Sarah, as well. And you've heard of Pinkney's many credentials before. Maybe I should say he's published a ton of things everywhere, and he's won all the literary awards, and he's a cutting edge VR creative artist, VR artist, among many other things. So welcome to the Monster Professor, and thanks for coming, all three of you.
No, if I'd had any idea it was all going to be so exhausting, I wouldn't have encouraged them so much. But now it's like, you can't just say this is my student anymore. There's like this, you know, this yard-long rap sheet that goes with them. And you too, Josh, you also have good news, I gather, on the job front. You have enjoyed a recent promotion.
Oh yeah! Well, thanks for bringing that up. I just found out this morning that I'm promoted now to the rank of full professor, and so I think that's the top of the line. Except if I could officially get on the contract that I'm Monster Professor, that would be one notch up.
That would be, if I ever have the money to endow a professorship, I'm going to endow the Monster Professorship at Kaskaskia. And will be the first and eternal recipient of that honor.
Well, thank you. And so I wanted to talk with the three of you is because at a recent Zoom meeting with a mutual publisher of ours, Press 53. They're a great publisher as well. The three of you came on to share with us all sorts of options that writers have available to us during the quarantines and the lockdowns, all sorts of, but not only during that, but beyond, there are all sorts of avenues available to us and all sorts of media out there that we can work with as writers, as storytellers. And it struck me that, man, all three of you involve monsters in the supernatural in your work. All three of you are quite tech savvy and willing to experiment. Also, Pinkney, you've made great points about amateurism and the spirit of amateurism. So I thought, man, I want to get this conversation going on the podcast because I'd love people to hear it. So maybe we'll start with the monster and the supernatural. We'll kind of take turns and then interrupt each other as we feel necessary. I'm curious about the kind of monsters and supernatural beings that have shown up in your work. So what monsters or what supernatural elements have shown up in your works, and why go with a monster? Why go with the supernatural? Why deviate from what we typically consider to be realism? So maybe we'll go around our Brady Bunch block of faces here, and we'll start with Mandy, Sarah, and then Pinkney. What kind of monsters and supernatural elements and why in your work?
For me, it depends on the work itself. I've explored a lot of different ones. Lacrimosa and the other books in the series that it is in deal with androids. And that's always been something that's really interesting to me. Just first of all, sci-fi as a whole. I grew up on Star Wars and Star Trek and Stargate, all the star things, basically. I wanted to explore what the future would be like. And for me, that involves robots in some capacity. And androids, I love, you know, that they're very close to human, not quite. And exploring the dynamics between, is the android the monster or is the person who created the android the monster? And it turns out to be the latter quite a lot in my books, just because the androids do what they're created to do. They may not have been created for a great purpose, and they may not have much of a choice, and they seem to gain more of their humanity when they figure out that they don't want to be whatever it is that their creator tried to make them be. And some other works, I have done some YA vampires and witches. I'm trying currently to finish up that novel and shop it around but exploring the different types of vampires and types of witches that are out in popular culture, and just how far we've come from Dracula to Twilight, you know, and all the different interpretations of the lore. And it's fun to kind of try to carve out my own area in that and interpret the myth in different ways. And the novel that is my thesis is also sci-fi, more of a space opera. It's got some telepathy and telekinesis and more humans having supernatural powers. And that's fun just to, you know, imagine ourselves in that way and see, you know, maybe in a few hundred, few thousand years what we could be. And it does that make us the monsters?
Yeah, and I've switched my background in honor of the sci-fi talk to the Nostromo, and maybe a little bit of Android something. I don't really know what that is. and Mandy, I thought at first before
Maria from Metropolis, right?
Yeah, I think it's a Metropolis inspired kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a Maria headband you've got on, and I'm the robot queen. We're doing a lot of gender bending here.
And Mandy, when you first came on, I was kind of like, before you clarified you were Queen Amidala, I was guessing a Dune kind of Bene Gesserit witch or something like that. So Mandy, why go space opera? Why go vampires and witches? Why not tell the same kinds of stories without the monsters, the far future, the supernatural?
It's honestly just more fun. I feel like it's entertaining to see a world other than ours. You know, we see this world every day, and especially at a time like this, whenever our world is extremely stressful, it's fun to go somewhere else. And, you know, either somewhere or another time.
Yeah.
Like to, you know, imagine what could be, not just what is.
Very cool.
I agree. Yeah, it's a lot more fun than being, I mean, you know, it's all fun, right? It's you know, putting on masks is fun. Or, I mean, fun maybe is too light a word for it. But I mean, yeah, there's real joy in exploring your imagination and not having to be, you know, some sort of, well, you know, like super dignified. But I say that, but I'm completely wrong. Like, because Mandy is a queen right now, right? I mean, you know, so that's not undignified. Like, that's more dignified than all, you know, everybody else in our dungarees and our, you know, our, you know, sort of working man clothes and stuff like that. Like, and it's not like, you know, other people have to make you royalty, right? You just like, nope, I'm royalty. And you put on the accoutrements of royalty and you hold the scepter in your hand and, you know, there you go. Like, it's, you know, I love the permeability now. The idea that we can bring these fantasies to life, right? We don't have to pretend we're rational people writing about irrational people. Yeah. So I don't mean to interrupt, but I just, the fun is exactly right. And it's so vastly undervalued. In academia, it's undervalued. And in like serious writing, I can't figure out why. Like it doesn't make any sense.
And there's something about building a whole world that's so satisfying, especially, you know, making this world function, and it has its own rules, and you can continue working in the world from a different character's perspective if you've set it up well enough that it's, you know, fully imagined. And it's fascinating to me how much we can create.
Right? I mean, I guarantee the worlds you make up are as real to you as the world you're sitting in right now, right? With scissors behind you and like real world objects. Yeah. I mean, isn't that fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. No, I mean, and you can tell in your work because you just fall into that work, you know, as though you were writing about, you know, kitchens and, you know, hybrid cars and so on and so forth. And, you know, but you're writing about starships and you know, and supernatural creatures, but it reads like they are normal things, right? They're just normal in that world. And that's a, you know, that's where you want to be, right? That's paracosm.
Yeah, and Mandy, how do you go about world building? And that's probably too big of a question to even begin to answer. But I really enjoyed it. You know, with I enjoy it with my shorter works, but I really got myself lost in it and really found myself enjoying it in my novel. And I think my process went something to the effect of, I had a general idea of the kind of world I wanted to build with just up one or two premises. And then I decided I was just going to figure out all the details as I went along. And somewhere between about halfway through the novel, I'm just making notes to self, go back and change this rule about the reality in your world and keep writing now as if you already fixed that and worry about it later and stuff.
Yeah.
And so important details I didn't figure out until halfway through. So, mm-hmm. so what's your process and advice for those of us, you know, thinking about enjoying and creating, you know, world building in our own worlds?
My process is very similar to yours, it sounds like. The advice would be, it doesn't have to be perfect on the first draft. You don't have to know when you sit down to write chapter one, everything about the world yet. And it's going to come to you the longer you spend with the characters and as you figure out what feels natural to them and to the time and the place that they're in. And if you just put yourself in that character's headspace and just kind of let them explore, you don't have to necessarily put every scene that you write with them into the book, just have them explore the world. And, you know, through more drafts and potentially, you know, do short stories in the world too, and just explore different corners of it. And you don't know what, you know, something you discover in one of those places might end up in another place, just as an, you know, incidental thing that isn't as important to the plot as it was in the other, but it connects the world. And there's all, you know, just build up the society to them to a degree that it is as real as ours is, like Pinkney was saying. It just, you have to inhabit them.
Yeah, thank you. Pinkney has just been beheaded and put into a plastic bag. He looks hermetic and sanitary now, and he's a floating face in a bag.
One day we will all be pure.
and so Sarah, what kind of monsters and supernatural elements have shown up in your creative works, and then why, and what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think a lot of mine have been if not outrightly religious, then at least in that like religious horror kind of arena, and I love that kind of stuff. I was raised Catholic, and everything related to that kind of like ritualistic horror is just fascinating to me. In the novel that's coming out in August, there is a monster that is actually like a sentient colony of mushrooms that lives in a in an abandoned mine shaft. And so that was weird. The main character Beth actually has an interaction with the mushrooms. The monster's name is Leviathan, and that's taken. It's literally just a ripoff of one of the beasts in Revelation. literally, all you have to do is like go to a random page in the Bible and just like close your eyes and like point your finger at something, and it's probably something cool that you can rip off and write a story about, which is really what I do, like 75% of the time, I would say. It's a colony of mushrooms, and they actually infect Beth, the main character, and sort of send her out on a quest to really destroy the world, and she tries her hardest. And I think
this
what's fascinating,
comedy, by the way, this, I mean, partly it's a comedy.
Yeah, well, it is a comedy, and I remember Pinkney when I was about halfway through the book going to your office hours and talking about it, and you were like, do you understand that this is a comedy? Like, I was like, oh my god, like, I had been thinking of it as, like, deadly serious. Meanwhile, the main character is, like, always high on shrooms and is just, like, knocking things over and, like, falling on her ass and getting tased and, like, peeing herself, and I was like, oh yeah, I guess it is, you know, like, a little bit funny. So I love the idea of a monster that, like, definitely exists, is 100% real. It's not some kind of metaphor. This is a real colony of mushrooms that actually speak, and it exists in a mine shaft, and you can go there and you can talk to the monster, but it's going to infect you. It's going to put something inside you that you can't get rid of. And I just love the idea of a monster that can not just kill you, but it can change who you are as a person. It can change everything about you. That's always fascinated me.
There seems to be, and I have no idea how intentional or not, so I guess it's more of a question. Like, so you're bringing up the religious influence, and I think you called the Catholic rituals the horror of the rituals, which is curious and interesting. And and then your main character ingests this mushroom and is changed internally, and that sure sounds like communion to me. That sure sounds like the ingesting of the body of Christ and stuff. And is there some type of religious communion connection with mushrooms, or are you just afraid of mushrooms? What's up with that?
So I think you're definitely right that it is supposed to mirror the Eucharist, the communion. It's the literal consumption of a god, not just human flesh, but the flesh of a god. And I think what could be more fascinating, in my opinion? And like, yeah, so the mushrooms, and it's sort of like, I do a lot of research about saints, particularly the mystics, the ones who have these crazy visions all the time. A lot of them have been reported to go into these fits of ecstasy when they receive the Eucharist, and where they sort of go like pale and rigid and float like 5 feet above the ground. So I think that kind of thing, where if you ingest this thing that humans somehow have this like precious access to, that is, it can literally transport you. And I think psychedelic drugs and stuff like that, I think that's kind of the closest thing that we have to that, if you're someone who doesn't believe in that through religious practices. I think that's kind of the next best thing, basically, or a better thing.
Yeah, and actually, anybody watching this right now must think that they might be on shrooms right now, because Pinkney has transformed into some sort of like psycho killer clown, which with a bloody nose. And what makes it creepier to me is that he's at an open window for some reason, like this nice kind of idyllic scene.
Ritter's clowns with bloody noses also get to live in nice places.
No, it looks like you just came in through the window.
I buy that. That's a good story. See? You see a couple of things and you build a story out of them. It's what we do. It's all we do.
Yeah, that's true.
And I've just transformed into a talking skull and a wraith of some type. Bone wraith, I think, is the Snapchat lens.
I'm trying to say what kind of skull that is. Like maybe a dog skull or something.
Yeah, it looks like a cat. Yeah.
Yeah, a cat or a possum or something like that. I'm not really sure. And let's go in front of the Roseanne background.
See, but then these horrific creatures in these kind of domestic settings are, you know, that's just my favorite thing.
Yeah, the background for this animated skull-faced wraith is the living room in Roseanne, the TV show from the 80s and 90s, which had Godzilla in the background right about in there on the mantelpiece for all the years. So one of the many places Godzilla shows up. And so Sarah, maybe one more note or one more question for you on that. The connection between comedy and horror, I'm convinced that there's not much of a line, not much of a difference between the two, but I've never really gotten into that in the podcast. So what are your thoughts on this connection to, or this overlap of comedy and horror of all things? I don't know what my question is other than what's up with that?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there is basically no line. It's why, like, comedians tell the most humiliating stories. I mean, the biggest horror can just be embarrassment, like sheer humiliation, and like how horrifying to be in public and like pee yourself or something. Like, that is horror, but it's also hilarious. And yeah, so I think you're right, there's no line. And I think movies like recent movies, like Jordan Peele's movies, specifically Us, I think movies like that really are really blurring the line in a more obvious way. And I mean that in a good way. So yeah, I think they're totally connected.
Very cool. So,
Oh, he's gone.
Did I just go away? Let me try. Okay, I'm back as just now a floating skull here.
Rat is skull. I want to be devil doll. It's been the early days of the internet, back before anybody else knew about the internet besides me.
Yeah,
I mean, you were devil doll and rascal.
Yeah, that's what in the hell is am I now? Now I turned into some sort of blue clown.
I love a technology where you can push a button and then go, "What the hell am I now?"
So Sarah has just turned into a chicken before our eyes, and that's whoa, that is scarier even than with eyes.
It's my favorite thing.
Oh man. Just, I don't know why that cracks me up so much. It is funny and horrifying. I think that's,
yep, it all connects. Yeah,
there you go.
And Mandy now has her mask on, which not only is quite cool looking, but it's probably safest because I don't know if any viruses can travel through Zoom or not. So it's best to be safe.
True.
And I
made it.
Oh, very nice. Cool. It says Star Wars themed mask. Very cool.
You get to declare who you actually are in the mask, right? You know, and you can always play it off like Jon Stewart, you know, where, you know, I'm just a comedian, you know, it's just a mask. And it's like, yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Seeing you, you know, in front of the hordes with their spears and pennons, and you've got your war helmet on, and you're yeah, exactly. I gotta say, that is not just pretend. I think we're seeing the real thing there.
Yeah, right now I went with a Norse helmet look with glasses still on, and
yeah,
and
no, then the glasses always make it look. That's how we know how smart you are. Or maybe not just.
Yeah, and I think so many Vikings would have done even better had they had the advantage of glasses.
Well, no, I think that's exactly right. When you imagine that all those people were wandering around, probably seeing the world the way I do, which is just, you know, bizarre blur out beyond about 3 feet. And for whatever reason, my new prescription does not allow me to see things close up. So now my glasses are on and off. Like, I have them off right now because I can't get used to the bifocal thing in them. And so now if I'm looking at my phone or on the computer, I don't wear glasses and I can see close up, but the entire world around me is like a green screen. It could be, anything could be happening.
Do you ever think about how, like, if you did have to live back then, like how fast you would die?
All the time. When, you know, when I was a kid, you know, and I had appendicitis at 14. I would have died when I was 14 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, if not well before then, just because I was sort of a blind, clumsy, fat kid. You know, so, I think this is the only era in which the blind, clumsy, fat kids have a chance of making it through.
Yeah, that's the title of your memoir, by the way.
Blind, clumsy. Actually, the only stab I have ever made at a memoir or autobiographical story was called Hogbody, because that's literally the worst insult I've ever received in my life.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, but now, and it's just sort of a military, you know, term for fat people, hey, Hogbody. And now, like anything, you can end up owning it. You know, I'm like, you know, hogs are really sort of, you know, strong and fierce, and they're very intelligent, and so I'm okay with it now. I've come.
Yeah,
are
that's
we doing therapy. I'm sorry. I thought we were talking about monsters. I thought we were just talking about, you know, my sadness,
childhood trauma.
Well, it does cross over quite a bit, right? Like you're not a monster if you're included. The monster, like part of the definition of monster, is this outlying, excluded thing that everybody wants to hate, fear, and get away from. And sooner or later, somewhere along the stage or stages of evolution in monster tales, or even within a story of a monster tale, or the retelling of it, say with the Frankenstein stories or the Dracula stories. Is something like realizing that the monster and the excluded thing maybe wasn't the true horror all along, and then a lot of them seem to have this like theme of embracing this horrible thing you're seen as, like taking an insult and turning it around. But I mean, that's kind of strangely empowered people throughout history, like King Rolf Crocky, like that wasn't his real name. He just took that because that was an insult kids used to throw at him as they were kid Vikings, right? And he was skinny, meant something like skinny twig of a twerp or something. And he confronted after he became conqueror and Viking lord king, and then confronted one of his old bullies as a kid and thought, you know, you used to call me Hrolf Krocki. That's my new name. Now all shall fear Hrolf Krocki.
Exactly. I mean, Yankee Doodle, right? I mean, yeah. like what all of those, you know, you just take it on and you own it. And yeah, I mean, it's the way I've come to love the word hillbilly. You know, I'm just like, because what could be cleaner, you know, like clearer or more, you know, tribal, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just so clean and clear. Like, yeah, call me hillbilly. What problem would I have with that? How would I deny it? And by the way, most of the best people I know are hillbillies, either literal hillbillies or they act like hillbillies, you know, or could be hillbillies. So I'm totally fine with that. That's a, you know, but the people who called me that have meant it as an insult.
And so, Pinckney, we've talked some before about some of the monsters and supernatural elements that showed up in your fiction, and feel free to chime in on some more of them that maybe we haven't talked about before, but maybe you could bridge us into the next question I want to get into. One of the reasons I wanted you three in particular to talk with me on the podcast is what is the future of storytelling? And what's possible in this future of storytelling that all three of you are already full speed ahead into? And is there a place for monsters in this new future of storytelling? So what's going on? What's going on with the various media and with various storytelling forms? And then what are you up to with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess, if I tilt back, you can see my green screen. I need to relax. But I'll just make a brief pitch about what we're doing at SIU in the fiction program at SIU. You know, for me, the perfect analog of story has always been dream, right? That in dreams, fantastical things can happen. Emotions are heightened. A dream is never dull, even if the components of it might seem mundane or slightly dull in, you know, in recitation. Dreams are never dull. You're always on, you know, tenterhooks. You're and the illusion is complete. You fall completely into the dream, generally speaking, right? You don't question the reality of the dream despite unreal. It replaces your reality. It's fully immersive. And the closer we've gotten to that, you know, as we've gone along, and I feel so blessed and happy that I've been able to watch, you know, from moving from, you know, the typewriter and kind of fuzzy television, then, you know, movies used to thrill me. You know, when I was a kid, like, I remember every time I still get excited when I see, Columbia Pictures or whatever come up. Cause when I was a kid, I was always like, okay, you know, what I'm going to see in the next like 90 minutes might change me forever. Like I might leave this a whole different person from who I came in. It didn't happen often, but it did happen. Like with Apocalypse Now, you know, I saw that, I think it was 15, and I was a different person and a different artist. You know, if I was an artist at 15, you know, but I was just different when I left. And that's what dreams can do. And now what technology has done, and if we look at this particular, you know, Murderer's Row or Rogue's Gallery, whatever we want to call what we are now, the dream now extrudes into the world, and you don't have to be trained. One of the things that has worried me is the stratification of people who are able to partake of the dreams that we tend to make in academia, right? That we're not making like beginner stuff. We're making stuff only people who are trained like us can enjoy and do enjoy, right? And this has happened completely in poetry, as far as I can tell. I don't know that anybody in our society reads poetry now except poets. And it's beginning to be true about a lot of different kinds of fiction. Yeah, and the truth is it takes, you know, what does it take? 20 years probably to train somebody like we are all trained, you know, 20 years, probably $500,000. So it's like training a fighter pilot to be able to draw out from the abstractions of the squiggles on the page to make those abstractions real, right? To create the theater of the mind, the sort of discipline that draws out of those abstractions. And what technology seems to me to be doing, and I'm kind of theoretical about it, but I'll let the rest of you talk about it maybe in practical terms, is like in VR, in film, there's relatively little abstraction because we do see things and we're used to seeing things and making patterns out of it, right? So that's why film is a less elitist, or television is a less elitist medium than writing, because you're one layer of abstraction away. You don't have to make the images yourself. You can see the images and make the story out of the images. And things like, you know, what we're doing here with, you know, wearing masks and being in make-believe environments, that's one step further. And then with things like with podcasting and the audiobooks that my students are working on now, and both Sarah and Mandy have been involved in an extremely successful project that we're doing at SIU with audiobooks with SIU Press. You've got the sound, you've got, rather than reading the symbols on the page, you're hearing them the way people have heard stories told for, you know, probably 10,000 years at a minimum, right? And so we're everybody's conditioned to that. Everybody's used to it. It's not a newfangled thing. And then when you get into VR, it seems to me yet more ancient still, because that really is the dream, right? I mean, it is thoroughly immersive, and it's not even like a film or television or you know, a podcast or audiobooks, which are confined to the ear, and, you know, film and television, which are confined to a two-dimensional plane in front of you. Like, we're not meant to see two-dimensionally, right? Like, we've got eyes that are offset from each other by a very certain amount in the front of our faces. And that makes us, one, it makes us predators, and two, it means that we interpret the world as three dimensions. And so there's a certain amount of abstraction when I look at a screen and it's got a flat version of Josh on it. And I'm sort of extracting, because of my knowledge of the world, I'm extracting or drawing from that abstraction the idea that there is a three-dimensional you, right? But there's still a level of abstraction there and still a level of interpretation that you have to be trained to, right? My dog looks at a television and doesn't react, right? Might react to the sound of it, right? So there's not, but in VR, like even dogs get VR. Everybody gets VR because VR is, you know, I mean, it's real. And it makes that imaginary world real, not yet fully tangible, although that's coming. And there aren't those levels of abstraction. It's why, for instance, people who don't like to play games on the computer, you know, because you're using the WASD keys and the mouse and so on and so forth, that all of that movement is abstracted, right? In VR, you're not doing that abstraction, or at least it's at a much reduced level. You're actually touching things. You're actually picking things up with your hand. You are moving your head around corners. You are in a world that is reacts recognizably the way our world does, but that can be made, you know, into the, it can have the dream elements, the supernatural, the fantastic, the monstrous. Also in VR, and one of the most important things about VR is scale. Yeah, that when you see the Minotaur, right, or Godzilla in VR, it's not a 2-foot-tall monster on your screen, but you can see he's next to a 18-inch-tall building. So you go, okay, he's bigger than a building. I can draw from that. He's just boom, right? Like you have to look up, and there it is, and it's full size. And there's really something to that we don't, that the level of interpretation and abstraction is drawn down. Right, with each advance, that seems to me the way we're moving in our art. Now, people lament that, and I understand it. Right, it's nice to be a specialist. It's nice to be the only person who can read, whoever, whatever contemporary writer you want to think of, and understand the nuance and so on and so forth. But I'm actually interested in making an art that is general, if not universal. Right, and that normal people who aren't MFA students can pick up and immediately see this is a story that fits like the ancient thing at the back of my skull, right? This is not a forebrain story. This is not a story I have to understand. It's a story I can feel and experience and inherit in a way. And that's a lot of the stuff we've been working toward at SIU, is rather than working toward making our, as they say in Spinal Tap, making our audience more selective. We're trying, I think, to understand why the highfalutin skills we have work really well, not to just make stuff clear to other highfalutin people. That's relatively easy, right? But how do you tell, how do you tell complicated, immersive stories to that a general audience can understand? And both of these writers, both Sarah and Mandy, are expert at that, right? Like they both write at a very high level. They both understand the mechanics of what they're doing, as well as have a sort of instinct for it that they came with. Neither of them, right, is writing a literature that I could have picked up as a kid. I could have picked up as that 14-year-old kid who would have died in any other time and read it and gone, wow, this is so exciting. You know, there's plot here, there's adventure, there's terror, there are attractive characters, there are, you know, all of that I would have understood, four decades ago. And, and my friends would have too. Right. And that's, so that's what, I guess. So what we're trying to do is make literature that a hillbilly kid could have understood in 1978.
Yeah. Or I always wanted to write the book that a little girl has to hide under her pillow or her mom will take it away. Cause I mean, that's what I did. The kind of book that, I read The Color Purple when I was like 7, I think. And I just remember thinking like, oh my God, like no one can know, you know what I mean? And that's the kind of book.
Right. And now you're a grown up and nobody around you knows that you're a grown up. That was, for me, that was the Hawkline monster. That was Richard Brautigan's Hawkline monster.
Yeah.
It was given to me. It was called a Gothic Western. And it was a nice little old sort of third grandmother lady who knew I liked monsters and she knew I liked Westerns. And so she got me this Gothic Western, it was called. And I remember reading it and there are characters who say fuck and there are characters mm-hmm. who do fuck. And, you know, just, okay, nobody else gets to know I like this.
Yeah, exactly. Or like my mom got me the book Watership Down and I was like, oh, yay, bunnies. Right. Like, holy shit. Like I had nightmares for like 6 months.
Yeah, so maybe we'll pass the conch shell off to you, Sarah, and tell us a little bit about the future of storytelling as you're exploring it and the projects you're getting into and what your thoughts are on it.
Yeah, so like Pinkney said, we're doing an audiobook right now, and it's an audiobook about Charlie Berger, who, if you don't know, he was a Prohibition-era gangster in Southern Illinois with just a fascinating life. And it's an audiobook that has lots of different characters, and each character is voiced by a different person instead of like some dude doing like a a woman's voice.
Oh no, I don't know, Charlie.
Yeah, and it's just like so disturbing.
That's crazy.
So the idea that like no one has, well, I'm sure some people have done this before, but the idea that like this is new is kind of crazy to me.
Well, the fact that it was called by one of our faculty members, the idea, when I introduced the idea of creating audiobooks with, you know, underscoring and sound effects and voices, you know, and stuff like that, he's, well, it just sounds kind of goofy to me, you know, and it's really funny. This person who's younger than I am, and I just thought, well, so like theater seems goofy to you? You know, like do you go to the theater and you go like, why is that guy saying Hamlet's lines and that other guy, keeps saying Ophelia's lines? Like, what are they, what's up with that? Like,
what are they going for?
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, and they keep like when they're, you know, they're, when the script says they're trumpets, like they actually fucking play trumpets.
Yeah. What the fuck?
That.
Yeah, so it's like, what the heck are we even, what are we doing? Like, why isn't this already a thing?
Yeah, but it's nice that so many things aren't a thing, right?
Yeah. Because
all these things that you think, well, somebody surely must have done that. And it turns out no, or never in a serious way. And, you know, and you're right. Getting great traction with the audiobooks. Like we've got a meeting with tons and tons of university folks from all over the university on Friday to talk about this project.
Yeah, it's like people are responding to it and it's like, it's not that hard to make. Like everyone should do it with their own work. I think that is gonna be the future as more and more people just completely stop reading words on a page, which is understandable. It takes a long time, it takes effort, and people just don't want to make the effort sometimes. I know I don't. I would much rather watch Netflix than read sometimes. So, and why not? There are great shows on Netflix that can teach you more about writing than some books can. So like, I don't think there's a need to sort of mourn the death of literature in a way. Like, I mean, I understand it and like I think about it a lot, and I just think, you know, maybe someday it'll come back, maybe it won't. Who knows? No one knows what's gonna happen, and I think that can be really exciting instead of having to be like sad or like pretending to be sad about it.
I think a lot of people are pretending
yep.
to be sad about the death of many, many things.
Yeah,
you know, the bricks and mortar university is going by the wayside, and many people are actually sad about that because it breaks their rice bowls. But you're not allowed to say, you know, you're some kind of weird, you know, atavistic monster if you say, well, you know, it's about time. Like, why have we been? This is way better than Fainter, right? Wouldn't you say, Mandy? Would you say, Sarah, Josh? You all know Fainter. Like, is this in any way less? A less efficacious way for us to you know, trade ideas and theories and thoughts than, you know, than Fainter is. You know, could I have this face in Fainter?
Right. Yeah.
Fainter, I mean, by the way, is a horrible classroom building in on our university campus at Southern Illinois. And
it's, you know, it's an above ground concrete bunker, I think. And as I told my creative writing students when we were doing a creative writing workshop in Zoom, the only difference that appeared to me was that we couldn't smell each other. And that's not something I really miss, so that's fine. I mean, we can do everything we can do in a classroom right here.
Undergraduates. That's how I know I'm teaching. Like victory.
Oh God. The smell of Axe body spray in the morning.
And Starbucks. Yeah, yep. Axe body spray and Starbucks. So Mandy, what kind of stuff are you getting into with the future of storytelling and exploring the different media out there?
Well, what we're doing with A Night of Another Sort, which is the Charlie Berger book, is what I did with my Shadows of the Mind podcast.
Yeah, Mandy's been way ahead of us. Mandy's been way ahead of everybody on this.
Truly.
We did, right now, the first season, which corresponds with the first book in the series, is done, and it's narrated. When each character narrates, they're played by a different person, and their dialogue and other characters' chapters the same way. With music and the sound effects, that was the really fun part for me, was trying to take this futuristic world and create it in three dimensions through sound. And I think it transports you in a way that reading it on the page doesn't, because you're suddenly in this world. You can hear plasma guns, you could hear what an android sounds like when they run. And it's a lot of fun to just think about what that could be. And then it's satisfying whenever, you know, people are listening to it and they can finally understand what this world is kind of already in my head. And so that's been a great experience to do that. And that was what I did with the piece for the Miller Audio Prize, which was set in the same world. And I think, you know, that might have been one of we think that it was the first sci-fi piece that the Missouri Review has published.
Yep.
And it is, I'm wondering if it was one of the first pieces that kind of did that as well, with the multiple voices and effects and things like that. But in addition to that, trying to create all of these worlds in additional dimensions, you know, we're doing that through things on the internet too, like have a wiki for that universe. And, you know, it helps, not only helps me stay organized in terms of, you know, I can keep the characters' bios and timelines organized that way, but it could be something that someone could stumble across on the internet and make them want to read the books, make them want to get invested in the world. And that's a lot of what we've been doing through other media, like even TikTok, which is how I got started doing this stuff. Because
you really made quite a hit on TikTok.
Thank you. I passed 700 followers now and about 13,000 likes across.
Queen of TikTok.
But it's just interesting because you have to tell a story in a short amount of time. We're used to having a set amount of words, and now you have a set amount of seconds. And, you know, can you be engaging in 15 seconds? Can you tell a story that people want to see and want to stick around and learn more? And I think that it's also a good way to, you know, build your platform, because if you can tell stories that way, people might be interested in the stories that you're writing, and you can advertise yourself that way and get to know your audience more than we normally do from just putting our book out into the world and hoping that somebody picks it up.
And Mandy has all along been, you know, really pioneering in what she does. She was the first person I knew who did Twine, right? The choose your own adventure platform in a really serious, rigorous way. She was the first person to really take on, well, and Sarah did this too, to take on the no sleep subreddit on Reddit, right? And start trying to tell stories in that way, in that sequential way. You know, and so the idea that these folks can make real good, significant stories in what people think of as insignificant or trivial media, right? You know, just as the novel was thought to be a trivial medium, you know, just as film was thought to be a trivial medium, just as still as until about 10 years ago, probably until either The Wire or Breaking Bad, television was thought to be a trivial medium, right? That you know, that these folks can inhabit any medium and tell significant stories. I swear to God, if you gave Mandy a bundle of sticks and some scotch tape, by evening she'd have built some interesting throne and stage, and she'd have a whole drama that would play out around it, and she'd have made herself a cool costume out of sticks and tape. You can give a really motivated, believing writer, right? A writer who really believes the story is real and alive in the world will make great narrative art with any medium or no medium. Yeah. And so that's been, you know, that for me has been like the great revelation of, you know, the last few years of my teaching life, is, you know, that the dignity of the medium, or the perceived dignity of the medium, is inconsequential. And all of these media that are dignified and that it's okay, it's non-goofy to be a part of, they've been revealed to be shams, right? Like, they're just falling apart around us. You know, the things you're actually allowed to do in an MFA program turn out not to be, they're just not working in the world anymore. And all the things like, oh, why are they wearing masks? You know, and VR, nobody's ever going to put that thing on their head. You know, oh, you know, why do you have the sounds of laser blasts in your show? It's just so odd. Like, all of that, it's like what we've been told is a lie. And I'm so glad, like, being, you know, you, Josh, you helped me start to figure this out years ago. I mean, I remember you telling me that, and maybe it's actually Melissa sort of, you know, translated through you, saying something like, you know, when you came to SIU to study creative writing, you know, Melissa was like, imagine, you know, a room full of creative writers. It's just going to be the craziest, you know, freest, most imaginative, thrillingest place in the world. And then when you get there, it's like a bankrupt Episcopal church. And I thought to myself, I'm like, why is that true? Like, theoretically, like, we love to make stuff up and wear costumes, and there are people, happily the culture is changing at SIU, but 5 years ago, like, you know, there were just people who were like, imagination. And it's just weird, like, you know, so now it's just such pure pleasure, right, to come in, and there are these folks who are like, you just say, like, hey, want to put on a show, want to wear some costumes, want to, you know, tell some weird stories, want to, you know, make some sound effects, like acting, you know what I mean? Like, who, you think of the people who you went to graduate school with here, Josh, and if I had said, okay, you have to pretend to be an old Irish mobster, and you know, you're going to pretend to be Queen of the Galaxy, and, you know, they had no idea what I was talking about. And these folks now, led, as I will say, by Sarah and Mandy, you know, they do anything, any kind of storytelling. And it's been inspiring to me. Like, it's changed my whole take on pedagogy, which I never really believed in, and now I really don't. And and on, you know, my own approach to my work and my own approach to my own, like, all that false dignity, right? When all I wanted to do was wear a t-shirt and a mask.
Yeah, and that's wonderfully said. And you, Pinckney, happen to be quite the leader in this field in many ways. And every freak like the three of us that you like motivate to go and try this kind of thing out ends up like dominoes, getting other people to do the same thing. There would be no Monster Professor podcast had Pinckney not just texted me one day and said something like, yeah, but why wait? Like, just do it. Because I was thinking, maybe I should think of over the next year, like trying to figure out what this podcasting thing is. And you're like, just do it. I'm like, yeah. Oh yeah, I'll just do it. And so now it's almost 2 years into this. In a few years, I think Pinckney and I will both be working for Mandy and Sarah in some form or fashion.
that is, I'm planning my retirement by making brilliant people think I helped them early on. That is my whole retirement plan at this point.
And well, man, at this point we're deep into an hour on the podcast, so maybe we should start reeling it in a little bit with, are there any projects that you would like people to know about, any promo kind of things you have going on, any final things places you'd like to direct listeners or viewers that we maybe haven't already mentioned, or maybe mention one more time. I'll just throw the ball out there, and anybody wants to grab it.
Well, I know a couple of people who have books coming out soon.
Yeah, Saint Catastrophe comes out in August from SFK Press.
Lacrimosa is coming out from Brown Chicken Books, which is an imprint of SFK Press, and I'm excited that we're going to have books out around the same time. Get maybe
very cool.
Yeah.
So, and you want to talk a little bit about the maybe I'll talk about the project and you can fill me in, but we're doing a podcasting audiobook project now at SIU. All of the fiction grad students, or almost all of them, are involved. There's the Charlie Berger book, A Night of Another Sort. There's a book called Survive by One, which is about a guy who killed his family, and it's an examination by his, a therapist and him of what he did. That's being dramatized. There's a book about Mother Jones that's being read by Judy Jordan, who basically is Mother Jones, and who's doing a great job. And there is a pair of books about the Rape of Nanking that are being put together in a very interesting way. Those will be a podcast on the NPR One platform via WSIU, which is our NPR affiliate for the whole southern part of the state. You should probably be able to get a WSIU up where you are, Josh. And then we're also going to have those will be coming out in about 15 to 20 minute segments. Oh, it's probably starting in the summer or very early fall on NPR One. And then we'll be sort of talking about them in a short talk show format on WSIU starting as they come out. And we'll do interviews with Sarah and Mandy and other folks who are involved. So that's a brand new project, and it's a partnership now between SIU Press and the Creative Writing Program and WSIU. And as far as I know, it's unique among creative writing programs. We now have a full-on partnership, and it's growing, with SIU Press, with a deeply reputable university press, and we're partners with them now in a lot of different initiatives. That's a brand new thing and a really exciting thing that's come about with the breakdown of respectability. Right now, everybody can talk to everybody else. You don't just have to talk to people who are kind of at your level or, you know, whatever, like if something's interesting, you can pursue it.
And it's really interesting, especially living in this area, because several of the books talk about Southern Illinois.
Yeah.
And the people that we're broadcasting to hopefully will recognize the area. And there's a militia that lived in Carbondale. There's a lot of...
Yeah, the Carbondale militia. That's a phrase that I will never forget hearing.
Right.
Wow. Carbondale used to have a militia.
And all the Heron massacre, all the shootings at the Heron hospital, it's like these places still exist. Like you can go there today.
Right. Yeah, how many, and the fact that the voice actors you're getting probably sound very much like the people they're representing, because they're Southern Illinoisans just playing Southern Illinoisans. And so, when some dude from rural Southern Illinois is just voicing some 1920s gangster, it's like, well, that's probably not too far from what that guy sounded like. It's really right. Good. I mean, I shouldn't have favorites, but that's my favorite. But this, nobody will ever know, because it's just between the four of us.
Right.
Well, I've really enjoyed this conversation. This has been a blast, and if you're still only listening to it when you get to a phone or a computer, you might at least check out the YouTube channel, The Monster Professor, if nothing else, just to see a few minutes of some crazy visuals of four people having a smart conversation about.
Can you do the llama? Sarah, have you got the llama key?
I do. Wait, hang on. I'll get
Sarah,
it.
Sarah has transformed into a chicken nugget, and I think she's using her magic. Now she's a miniature llama, which is pretty darn scary.
A llama with human teeth.
Yeah, that's the uncanny, isn't it? Like that, yes. That final little mixture of something familiar and something else familiar mixed together in unfamiliar ways, and we can't, and it's deeply disturbing to us. Well, thank you all again so much for coming on The Monster Professor, for talking monsters, supernatural, sci-fi with me, for having fun with masks and costumes and backgrounds, and then sharing some of your insights. You guys are the avant-garde. You are leading the charge into this new world of various new media and of bringing real cool storytelling along with it. And so I thank you for that as well.
Thank you for having us.
Always a
pleasure. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, this was really fun.
And it sounds so cute coming from this tiny little horrifying llama.
I think I could make just the llama filter into an entire podcast by itself.
I think that will not be hard to do. I think that's a real winner. And everybody could be a llama. Like everybody who comes on is just a completely different version of that llama. Just the eyes and teeth are different.
Yeah, it's required. Everybody has to come on as llamas, and llamas explain the world to other llamas. And
stuff. Mm-hmm. And maybe the occasional alpaca.
Right.
They have I'll the race wars.
every time it cuts to Sarah, it just cracks me up. All right, very good. This was a huge amount of fun. Thanks all for being willing to do this.